This is Isla Allgood of Women's Voices. Join me every Monday and Wednesday from 4 to 6 p.m. here on KNKRLP 96.1 FM Kohala.
Nix Chong. So I know she's living here in Hawaii, at least part-time. Phoenix, tell us, where are you from?
Technically, I'm living in Kapa'au because of the way these borders go.
And where are you from originally?
I actually grew up in Honolulu, Kaimuki District. So I'm from Hawaii, and I identify as from Hawaii, and it's been time, you know, I've been wanting to come back, and now as a senior, it seems like it was a good time.
Now, I know when we visit Honolulu, Kaimuki has some great restaurants. What was it like growing up?
Restaurant things weren't that big a deal then. I was growing up there in the 60s to around early 70s, so it was just very family-oriented. Walked around a lot, you know, it's...
So would you call it a suburban neighborhood?
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I remember now. I used to work at the... There was a Dick's Danish Pastry. I used to work there, and that was really fun.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah.
And did you go to public schools?
No, I went to Sacred Hearts Academy. It was it's a parochial Catholic school. And that was good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Catholics have a good background in education vis-a-vis like some of the Jesuit, and, you know, they don't try to reinvent the wheel constantly like I see in public school, which I've sent my kids to, you know, where they're talking about, oh, let's teach them algebra here or this or that. And I'm going, really? I mean... That's been the standard.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, you don't need to reinvent the wheel. You just, well, anyways, that's kind of a little bit on education.
So what kind of family did you grow up in? Did you have a lot of siblings?
No, I was adopted. And so I was born in China and adopted and came here in 59, I believe, when the state was still a territory. My parents... you know, had come earlier. My father came around the 20s or 30s. He was a merchant. He followed his older brother, who was also a merchant. In fact, they had a very well-known fabric store called Chong Silk House in the Fort Street Mall area. No longer there, of course. My father sort of did the same thing and had a fabric store called General Fabrics on South King Street. And then later on, closer to, I think, the 1950s, my mother came over. And then, you know, my brother and I, we both got adopted. They also had one natural daughter. And it turns out, you know, a lot of people in our extended clan, extended family, were adopted, and it was so amazing to find out as adults, really, we didn't know that growing up, but, you know, it all worked out well.
Yeah, so what was it like being, so your parents owned a fabric store?
Yes, and I think at some point, my father had a lot of, had asthma badly, and so he had to give that up, and they then ran a restaurant in the Kapahulu district called Family Restaurant. I think that was all it was named. And this was quite later in their lives, I think. And because, you know, the restaurant business was hard, my father had the idea to start a food truck. And we would sell manapua down near the UH. There was a parking spot, you know, that he somehow managed. And so we were one of these early food trucks already.
So did you get involved with the family business as early on?
Oh, definitely. Worked in the, I remember working at the restaurant now and then, but also at the food truck, helping serve and all that. The restaurant was also good because they used that as an avenue to bring over various other relatives that were starting to immigrate over because of, and you know, that provided a source of labor and income for the other family members that came later on.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say your life was like growing up? What are some memorable things from your childhood?
Very middle class, I guess, for that period. It was, you know, in retrospect, it was very, wonderful. At the time, it felt very restricting, and I wanted to, you know, see what else was out there in the world. But, you know, I just remember a lot of, great times. I mean, I could walk to, Queens Beach down near the end of Diamond Head area. You know, spent a lot of time there just, playing in the water and, being able to walk there and back. That wasn't bad. And then, of course, there was always work. Even as starting around high school, we always, it was, accepted or assumed that we would get a job. And so one of the first jobs that I got, I remember, was at Dole Pineapple Factory. It's, a lot of young folks, started out there. And, you're supposed to grade the pineapple and, put them in different cans. Well, that place was horrible in terms of noisy, smelly. But it, it hired a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so as soon as I passed probation there, I quit. And luckily, I was able to find a job at Crack Seed Center. This big Chinese woman ran several branches of Crack Seed Center. And Crack Seed, for those who don't know, is preserved plum, pretty healthy snack food, I'd say. Probably too much sugar or salt, but not bad in terms of it not being overly processed. And there was a lot of other, Japanese snacks in, like, cuttlefish or taco dried. And so we would, I would work there with some other young gals. And this was at the Ala Moana Center at the time. And right near the Ala Moana Center, there was this stage where that's where they had the free hula show for tourists and locals. So, that was kind of fun. And I remember being able to, ride a bicycle all the way, from our house in Kaimuki all the way down to Ala Moana. And that was pretty liberating. And I'm so glad to see now there's actually bike lanes and things there.
So was this while you were going to school, or was this after you graduated?
No, this was during school, during high school. I forget. I think it was weekends or summers. Probably summer is when we did a lot of that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I remember is that the first house I lived in was like right across from Cocoa Head Crater. And during the time of the nuclear alarms, one of the things was, how you get under the table. And
duck and cover.
Yeah, that, mm-hmm. Right. I remember seeing that. And then apparently one of the safest places to go was right across the street in that Cocoa Head Crater. There was some kind of shelter there.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that. Oh, yeah, that was really great. Great place to be. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So did you enjoy your school experience? Were you somebody that enjoyed going to school? Or
overall, I would say yes. Myself and a good friend of mine's, we tended to do the best in our class. She kind of outdid me, so there was always some rivalry there, but mm-hmm. We've become good friends since then.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, she's one of the few mathematicians, got a PhD in math and mm-hmm. taught computer. You know, really, she was great in terms of more intellectually, mm-hmm. more of a powerhouse. So that was great.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have concerns about going to the school you went? Did you wish you were going to public school or some other school?
You know, not really. I mean, at the time, that's all I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, the public schools supposedly had a bad reputation as being not as safe.
Mm.
But I think more it was just the preferences of my parent that they wanted a, you know, rigid or more academic experience.
Mm-hmm. And was that true for you and your brother and sister? Did you all go through the same school system?
We did. And mm-hmm. now Sacred Hearts is an all-girls school.
Okay.
My brother went to St. Patrick's as elementary and mm-hmm. then St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they did pretty well for us considering that, you know, they weren't rich. They were struggling and trying to meet tuition and all that. But for them, that was important.
It sounds like it was a high value that their children get well-educated.
It was for them, and I think it's, you know, it's part of the culture that got passed down, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really fun.
And was it an expectation that you would go to college?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In fact, the only way I was able to leave Hawaii and go to a mainland college that I wanted to, because, you know, at the time I wanted to see the world, was to threaten that I wasn't going to go to college if I had to go to UH. Well, they then, you know, I called their bluff, I guess, and they acquiesced and I was able to go there. But, you know, I was young and, you know, didn't realize how much that is in terms of an expense.
Mm-hmm.
And I, in retrospect now, I appreciate so much more of all that they did.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I went to USC in Los Angeles and that was quite, you know, quite an experience, quite different than Hawaii. But overall, you know, it was what I wanted to do. So I was, you know, you kind of have to do whatever is in your mind that you think you need.
How did you make that decision?
To go to USC?
Mm-hmm.
There was a year or two where my parents wanted to try out living in the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved there 1 year. My mother hated it.
To Los Angeles?
Yes, to Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And so moved back. So we were separated for a while, where my brother and I stayed with my father for an extra year.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the only place I knew at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, yeah, I'll go there.
Mm-hmm.
After, you know, when it was time. But by then, my father had moved back. You know, they were back in Hawaii, and you know, I guess I was the first one out because my sister stayed here,
mm-hmm.
and she went to UH, and she had other, you know, she got married and all that, so she had
mm-hmm.
other
mm-hmm.
interesting things happening to her here.
Mm-hmm. And did you have a particular profession in mind or area of study when you went to USC?
No, not at the time. But somewhere around my sophomore or junior year, I can't remember, I read an article about an equal rights advocate, an all-women law firm that started up in San Francisco. And I remember being very inspired by that. And at the time, I was, you know, I am proud to identify as a feminist, unlike some people now who say, you know, oh, that's a dirty word. But I was really...
Well, and after all, feminist just means someone who believes in equal rights for women, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And as a woman, too, I was looking for role models. You know, at mm-hmm. the time, there weren't that many. And just seeing other people, you know, other women doing that, I was really, you know, I was so impressed that instead of coming back for the summer that year, I went up to San Francisco and volunteered there and, you know, went there with, you know, not knowing anybody and really not knowing where to stay and all. I stayed in a Skid Row, you know, single res, what do you call it? SROs, single resident occupancy, just a little, a little room, and just so that I could check out what it was that they were doing.
And what did you find they were doing?
I liked what they were doing in terms of the kinds of cases that they were, getting into, and seeing, you know, where it was that they could advance the cause of women and what they can, the things that they can be involved in. Now, you got to remember, I mean, I had absolutely no skills, so I was just actually just hanging around and, kind of absorbing what it was that was there.
Maybe helping with some clerical work or something?
For the life of me, I don't remember. I just remember being in a conference room a lot and, you know, hanging out, talking with other volunteers. And I remember the Watergate hearings were happening then.
Wow.
And so, you know, we're talking a lot about that. And, I'm sure I did administrative things for them. But, you know, that was that summer, and it was opened my eyes to, okay, you know, that could be a career path. So that's why I went into law after I graduated.
So you finished at USC?
I did. I graduated and then took a year off, did I? Yeah, I think I did. I took a year off to just work because, you know, you get tired of constant academic and studying and all that. You kind of want to see, you know, just kind of take some downtime. So I guess that was my gap year.
Do you remember what you did during your gap year?
I do. I worked in the psychology department of USC. I was a psychology major, and I remember doing lots of, you know, lab work back when I was attending, trying to get my degree. And when I decided to not go directly into school again, they had an opening. So there was, and the receptionist and the secretarial just, helping do things. Made some great friends then. Shout out to Marianne Krempaski. She was actually the senior secretary, and she was very, she made it very interesting to work there. But I always knew I was going to continue on to schooling, so that was kind of fun.
Did you consider becoming a psychologist?
You know, I was interested in psychology from more of a personal viewpoint, and not so much. Although, you know, I did remember doing a study on altruism, so that, you know, there was some of that. But I was just practically oriented, and so it seemed like I had the bug of wanting to study law.
Well, that's very interesting, a study on altruism, which it doesn't seem like we have a lot of that around these days. Anything you remember about the study?
It was, we worked closely with one of the professors there. I was still, I think, junior or senior. Basically, it was interesting trying to figure out how to design an experiment so that you could test out the altruism part. And so we selected, I think, with his inputs, this, trick or treat. You'd have two baskets of where, you could, we could give you candy for yourself, or you can donate this candy to, this, poor kid who, doesn't have anything. And you kind of see, how that worked, whether they would, try to, what they would choose. And I remember we tried to either have pictures or something to sort of motivate people to either do the altruistic thing or do the, self-interest thing. And, I think, and then I remember that resulted in a paper that then got presented in American Psychological Association, one of those meetings. For the life of me, though, I can't remember what the results were. I just remember the study was very interesting to bring it out to, like, real-world surroundings.
Great. So after a year of that, then you applied to law schools?
Yes. I remember applying to law schools and got accepted to Hastings up in San Francisco. And, you know, it was a no-brainer. That one was a public school. And back then, you know, the California system did not skimp on higher education for their residents. And it's so different than now, where they're charging an arm and a leg for, you know, not only college, but professional schools and all that. And
yeah, we were talking about that the other day, how 40, 50 years ago, that the public education, especially the state schools, which had a reputation for being of high quality, were very reasonable, where now they're so expensive.
And, you know, you want your citizenry to vote with knowledge, you know, you've got to educate them so that we, you know, they can go through, you know, what's facts, what are opinions, what's supported by evidence. All those things are, you know, part of a good, strong public education system. And, you know, shout out to that. And we, you know, and that was one of the reasons I sent my kids to public school when the time came. Although even then, you kind of, the quality varied.
So how did you find going to law school, especially as a young feminist? How many, what was the percentage of women versus men in your classes? Do you remember?
Probably not more than 25%, if that, I think. I mean, it was mostly men. Oh, yeah, back in Los Angeles when I was going to USC, I also did a little work for a woman attorney, just, you know, odds and end. And I remember thinking, you know, when she was getting her JD, you know, I think she was probably only a handful, if even that.
Right.
So, you know, progressively, it was, I think it was improving. And I think now, you know, women probably are at least half, 50%, if not more, of some law school classes.
Did you experience any discrimination, do you feel, when you were in law school?
As a woman, probably part of it, you know, tended to sit back, you know, let, there's a lot of aggressive types in law and blowhards, you know, love to hear themselves talk. And, you know, you kind of just let that go and, you know, listen, you know, they tend to dominate discussions. And, you know, that was, that wasn't kind of my shtick. So, you know, I was more on the background and learning how to, yeah, trying to get through all the reading. The reading was just incredible.
Lots of reading, huh?
Lots of reading, trying to discern things and not quite understanding some of this, you know, what it is you pull out of some of these cases. And so it took a while. So, yeah, it was a tough slog through, but, you know, somehow I made it.
So you made it through.
I did,
so
somehow.
What happened after law school? And did you work while you were going to law school, or did you focus?
Yeah. I worked San Francisco neighborhood, SNFLAF, it was the acronym, Neighborhood Law Association Foundation or something like that. Yeah, so we worked there. Got that one, I got lots of good actual law-type experience, clinic-type work. That was under a work-study program.
What kind of cases?
They did cases for, you know, low-income people. You know, you don't hear about them as much now because their funding has gotten really curtailed. But, you know, there was a lot of eviction cases, you know, just run-of-the-mill things, you know, contract cases that might come up, you know, if they, you know, try and, you know, whatever difficulty that they have. Mm-hmm. And so there would be, you know, client intakes some of, you know, certain days of the week, and then, you sort of try to help them. A lot of it was eviction cases, I seem to recall.
Mm-hmm.
Probably there were some credit and cases, because the other kinds, like, you know, personal injury, you know, they can get private attorneys to handle that.
Right.
So these were for the more of the low income. Mm-hmm. And so that was, you know, I did that for maybe a few semesters and mm-hmm. a summer, and then, you know, worked for, you know, a private attorney, you mm-hmm. know, just to, you know, make some extra income.
Mm-hmm. How was that?
It was a little bit sexist, but but you know, and it kind of irked me. I remember him expecting me to make or bring him coffee.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of irked me, but on the other hand, it was like, oh, you know, it was, you know, he was a small practitioner, and mm-hmm. so I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I remember dragging my foot on that, but I did. You know, I'm not a real, you know, out there kind of person. And so, you know, I try to weave my way through as best I can.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, you know, after that, mainly I remember just studying for the bar. And during that time, I couldn't work and, you know, just spent a lot of time, you know, that was a full-time
full-time job, yeah, studying for the bar.
Yeah, that was great.
And it sounds like you passed it.
I did, finally. Mm-hmm. It took me two times, and I thought it would be the essay that would defeat me, but it turned out it was this multiple choice section of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, okay, so I did the multiple choice again. And, you know, to me, multiple choice, you can always kind of think like, okay, this one's not 100% correct because, you know, there's possibly this or that. And so, yeah, I thought there was more gray areas than should be on it.
And then what happened? What did that change your life a lot, passing the bar?
Yeah. Then I interviewed to work for firms, and like I said, that was hard. I'm not people's idea, or at least the accepted mainstream's idea of an attorney. And so,
in what way?
Well, I remember interviewing for some firm in Oakland, and they said, "Well, what are we going to do if, you know, you get married and you want to have babies?" You know,
which is totally illegal now.
Yeah, at the time they asked, I said, well, you know, well, who knows what's going to happen. So, yeah, so those kinds of things. And then, you know, nobody was offering me jobs, so, you know, I struck out on my own. I had fellow classmates that were just hanging out their shingle and, you know, taking on cases. So that's what I did. You know, there was a court-appointed attorneys for you know, criminal cases. So we did some of that. Pay was, you know, very minimal, but, you know, kind of got you into the experience of it. And then we went in, and then the cases came in. You know, you kind of go out and market yourself a bit, you know, go to community meetings and do, you know, I did the whole gamut of stuff at the beginning. I mean, there's, of course, unlawful detainers, the eviction, personal injury, real estate, you know, all kinds of stuff. And then you kind of narrow it down to what interests you more. So that went on.
We're going to take a break. We are talking to Phoenix Chung. It's so fascinating to hear your story. We'll hear more about her law degree and her avocations after. Stay tuned.
Aloha, North Kohala. Kohala Cares has moved its weekly food drive from Sushi Rock to the Hub parking lot. Those in need can drive to the parking lot and pick up a bag of groceries. Pickup begins at 4:30 every Wednesday. Please wear a mask. Donations, especially produce, will be accepted Tuesday from 1:30 to 4. and Wednesday from 3 to 4:30. We want to thank all our donors and volunteers for making all this happen. Remember, we're all in this together. Mahalo.
Woman, sister, do you hear me? You are the giver of life. Your blood is red.
This is Ila Allgood of Women's Voices. Tune in on Monday and Wednesday from 4 till 6 p.m. to listen to women from around the world, around Hawaii, songs with positive and empowering messages on KNKR LP 96.1 FM. Monday and Wednesday, 4 to 6 p.m.
Your bones are the trees in the forest.
Aloha, North Kohala. This is Holly Allgood back with Tutu's Talk Story here on KNKR LP 96.1 FM Kohala. Our very special guest today is Phoenix Chong, and we're just hearing about the beginnings of her legal profession, practice. So after you got a little settled, what happened next?
Working at getting cases and representing people and networking with, fellow students and colleagues and, signing up for all kinds of different bar associations, and you'd get referrals that way. And then got into representing union members. For example, the local restaurant and hotel workers union, and brought a constant flow of business. A lot of the union workers are, they need immigration help, and so we did that. A lot of were just the same run of the mill cases, unlawful detainers, whatever. Personal injury, got a little bit more into real estate cases and probate and estate planning. So towards the end, did that. I practiced for a good, it felt like 25, 30 years. Mm. And so then I said, okay. That was a good way to be able to work and raise a family and then I wanted to retire.
Uh-huh.
Once the kids were grown up and off to college.
So we missed that part. So it sounds like somewhere along the line you got married and had some kids.
I did. This was after law school, after bar review, and when I was practicing, I ran into my husband then, who was he was a fellow law student, but we didn't really know each other when we were in school. So we connected, and actually it was through him that I got introduced to a lot of the legal service plans, the union workers and all that. So,
mm-hmm.
He had his own practice, I had mine, and being self-employed was absolutely wonderful in lots of ways, because you make your own schedule, but then also you have to do everything yourself. So there were some difficulties there, but overall, that was all I knew, and that's what I did. You mm-hmm. just kind of keep, putting one foot over the other. And doing
so, more. Did you combine practices or did you stay separate?
No, we stayed separate. He initially had partners,
mm-hmm.
and I was always a solo.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, when he, lost his partners, the different ones, retired or went into other things,
mm-hmm.
He already had, his identity. I had mine,
mm-hmm.
and so we never combined, although we definitely cooperated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would, if it was somebody in the San Francisco area, I would, be able to meet clients at his office, or he could mm-hmm. meet his clients at my office because I was based in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow we, I look back on those days, I'm going, how did we do it? But, you know, we did.
Mm-hmm. When you say, how did you do it, and from what way? Because there was so much to do?
Yeah, or? So much to do, so little time, mm-hmm. so much stress. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure I didn't feed my kids right. I feel bad about that nowadays. But, you know, bless their heart, they managed on their own. Mm-hmm. I remember early on that... at a young age, they were making their own peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And then I kind of felt guilty after I saw a friend, you know, prepare the lunch for their kid. And so I decided I was going to do that too. And, you know, of course, that was the wrong move. And so anyways.
But it sounds like they're grown up now.
They are. Mm-hmm. They are wonderful. Mm-hmm. And... I, as a parent, you're always still worried about them and all that, but, knock on wood, they did okay. You know, mm-hmm. they're doing okay. Mm-hmm. Pleased that they're reasonably close. Mm-hmm. You know, they still have kind of an arm's length thing because they want to, learn the world on their own. Mm-hmm. And but I am also now, you know, as of last year, a first-time grandmother. Mm. And so...
Where's your grandchild?
In Oakland. With the mm-hmm. kid, mm-hmm. With my son and mm-hmm. my daughter-in-law. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just an absolute joy. I didn't even know I wanted to be a grandmother. But once that happened, it's like, oh... This is really fun watching a little one grow up again. And this time, mm-hmm. you know, more time, more relaxed. Mm-hmm. You know,
That's pretty much what I hear from every grandma.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you retired. What happened after you retired? Where did you put your time and energy?
We traveled a lot. My husband and I did lots of traveling, especially through home exchange, where we would, you know, exchange our home for the other traveler's home. We had wonderful trips in Europe. You know, I managed to put together 3 months in Spain. Mm. Love that. Our first one was in France. You know, just all over we did that. Mm-hmm. And now that with the COVID, and I'm going, well, thank God we did that before all this happened, because now it's going to be a little harder. Everybody's a little more scared.
Yes.
You know, the hygiene of a mm-hmm. place, you know, mm-hmm. a lot more, you know, carefulness. Mm-hmm. But we also did the nomad thing through the USA 1 year. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time I've seen, you know, all of the USA, because, I mean, I was... raised in Hawaii, pretty much stayed in the West Coast and maybe a few other states inland, but never saw the South, the East Coast, the North, and Midlands. And that was really an eye-opener, seeing the whole country
When did you do that?
2014.
Mm-hmm.
And
what were the biggest surprises?
How big our country is, yeah. Number mm-hmm. one. Mm-hmm. How much land there really is, even though people say, oh, you know, too many immigrants and all that. But I suppose it just depends, too many in urban areas. But there's a lot, and maybe there's no jobs. That's why in the rural areas that can be a problem. Just how different some of these places are. I mean, you know, the difference between New York City and where is that one place? There was that someplace in Mississippi where this small town mayor, it's the crossroads mm-hmm. From that song, and that the mayor was, you know, walking around and just being really hospitable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, seeing where some of our culture came from, you know, mm-hmm. Memphis, Nashville, you know, all these wonderful music places. That's because my husband's really into music.
Mm-hmm.
And also we had our bicycles with us, and so we would bike these rail to trail places.
Oh, nice.
And they were, you know, that was an eye-opener too. Oh, I know what really struck me. Our national parks.
Yes.
Absolutely gorgeous, mm-hmm. and so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't even think, you know, okay, Cape Cod, big deal, you know. What is that? Up in Maine, mm-hmm. I guess where the Rockefellers used to have their place that they then donated.
Arcadia,
yeah.
That's beautiful.
Oh, yes, some of these gorgeous, absolutely. And, you know, I heard a lot about Yellowstone, but to actually see it, you mm-hmm. know, and all that offered,
mm-hmm.
You know.
So you'd recommend the national parks?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And we need to keep putting money into it, you know, keep it improving it. Keep the natural beauty of a lot of these places, mm-hmm. which reminds me too of that Palulu Valley over here.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, don't be like the every time I read about it, you know, I remember the Joni Mitchell song about paving paradise and putting up a parking lot. And that's what I, you know, cringe if that's going to be its future. Mm-hmm. But anyways, enough of that.
Yeah. and I think during COVID, so many people have said that they've found solace and inspiration just going outside, and that's where it seems we're safest.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know Isla and I have been reading up more and more how studies all over the world are showing that our time outside and our time with nature is really healing. And
that's why I like the Japanese idea of forest bathing a lot.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Follow that.
Mm-hmm. Well, sounds like you've had some wonderful travels. So now
I
that
did.
You're not traveling so much, what are you doing?
I knew I wanted to retire or have a presence here in Hawaii. You know, what I know, and I miss the culture that's here, the easygoingness, the, you know, less aggressiveness that I remember have in the mainland. And I wanted the, I got into, you know, tropical plants, you know, I was, got introduced to cacao in Nicaragua, and I, from there, moved on to other tropical plants. And so I said, you know, I can't keep growing things in the Bay Area and having it die on me. So many cacao seedlings died on me there. So anyways, I moved. So I said, you know, if I can do it, I want to do it. So I moved. I started looking for a land here. And through the good graces of my real estate agent, are we allowed to mention that?
We don't like to mention companies.
Sure. Then, you know, found a place that I absolutely adore. And I also was into, you know, off-grid living, living a more sustainable lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
you know, less fossil fuel, the circle of usage. So, you know, not using good potable water to flush your waste away.
Mm-hmm.
All those ideas that I wanted to see actually implemented, whereas once you're in an urban setting, and it's understandable, the urban settings, you need those kinds of, sewer and public health services because there's so many of you around. So that was what was attractive for me, to find a farm, a rural place. And so that's where I am now. I'm trying, you know, I'm picking coffee, dealing with my solar system constantly. and then in retrospect, appreciating the community of, you know, I guess of the, you know, centralized utility systems, but still, I'm still into decentralized, distributed
mm-hmm.
energy,
mm-hmm.
And even the solar off grid has to be even more distributed, so that system is not, you know, you don't copy the centralized way of, you know, fossil fuel. Each device can be distributed on its own with its own solar charging and all. Mm-hmm. And that way you have, you build redundancy in your in your usage. Of course, that's all well and said. I'm not there yet.
So is your family supportive of this off-grid dream?
I don't know. I think they're kind of puzzled by what I'm doing. I do have a nephew who's into that, and I share a lot with him. Mm-hmm. And so I think they're waiting for me to make it so comfortable that they're willing to come over and enjoy it more. But, you know, I find it very comfortable, you know, except for the lack of energy here and there, which I've learned to live with. And then it takes you off the internet so much so that, you know, which was one of the reasons why I wanted to come here, is not, you know, be steeped so much in, you know, in the internet and the media, those kinds of things. So anyways, I really enjoy that.
So have you started planting?
I have. And my thing is I want to try to replant natives. Mm-hmm. One of the things I've looked for, and it's so hard to get, is the sandalwood ellipticum. Apparently there may be a waiting list that I can try to get on with the DLNR. I heard that really once, but I think they're practically extinct. This is the prostrate type of sandalwood. It's kind of important in my culture because the name for Honolulu in Chinese was Tanhengsan, which means sandalwood mountain. And of course, that got devastated back in the, you know, 1900s. And so I know, you know, that there are people now trying to repopulate that.
Yes.
And some of the, most of it are the tall sandalwoods. This one is more lower ones. So that I want to, I haven't heard people growing teak. I'd love to grow teak. That may not be, you know, natural.
There are native people out here who grow teak.
Yeah, but that's not necessarily indigenous, or maybe it is endemic, but it's certainly a wonderful tropic tree.
Well, and sandalwood, it's such a shame because I believe that we had a lot of sandalwood here, and yet it was, well, a lot of people say this island was raped of the sandalwood.
Oh, yeah.
And unfortunately, a lot of the sandalwood, that even some of the more ancient trees, what I've heard of recently is even those, some people have taken them, not realizing it was, I think people wanted to use it for the oil, and yet when they, after they cut it down, they realized it wasn't suitable for that, which really makes you want to cry because here it was not, you know, even have a purpose.
We have so many kukui nut trees. I mean, that's another thing. I want to figure out how to use the kukui nut oils. That the koa, you know, I'm too low for koa, but I, you know, this, they talk about the dry forest initiative, and that's more like the West Hawaii. I'm kind of more in the straddling between wet and dry, but I'd love to have a little bit more of, you know, the lowland forest type of plants growing back. That plus a few, you know, practical things like fruit trees and all that. Oh, I know. I just tried a ground cover for this creeping ilima, and that's a native, and it's not doing bad, but you know, it's got a long ways to go before that can cover, you know, a lot of the weedy grasses that are out there. I'm trying to, you know, it'll be a slow process, but that's fine with me because I'm going to keep at it.
Well, and it's very rewarding.
Yeah.
So do you, so it sounds like you've lived a very, very rich, full life, and you have many more years to go. Do you have any advice for our listeners, whether it be legal advice or planting advice or...
No legal advice on the air. Planting advice I like to get from others, actually. But my advice really is to take it easy on yourself in some ways. Mm. I think that hopefully will... but also challenge yourself. Hopefully that will extend your life. And you know, do things for the for others, the community. One of the things I'm really enjoying now is doing Kohala gleaning with Richard and his group. And
well,
they're always...
Tell us about that. I don't know that we... I've heard anybody
familiar?
Talking about it on the air.
Oh, okay. Kohala gleaning is basically, you know, if you got too many fruits and it's just dropping to the ground and just being wasted, you know, don't waste it. Call us. And the number is 808-889-1282. His name is Richard, and we're always looking for people who have, you know, too much fruit on a tree that's not, you know, convenient for them to hire people to pick or... whatever, just share it with the community. Because
and then
this,
what happens after you make the phone call?
He'll arrange for when it is when you want us to come over and glean. We'll pick what, you know, we'll follow whatever it is you want us to do. Then the fruits will be at the Thursday 4 p.m. Fruit exchange or plant exchange at St. Augustine's Church. And it's been going on now for, you know, maybe 3 or 4 months. And it's amazing, you know, if you need fruit or, you know, donate what you can, take what you can use. You can have some plants. I mean, I got a nice little avocado seedling because I've been wanting to grow avocado. And but also there's so many other, you know, we've gotten, you know, crates and crates full of fruits that would ordinarily would just drop to the ground. Of course, you know, it would then compost and then re-nurture the earth. But before that, it does that.
So is this fruit and plant exchange open to everyone? I mean, if
absolutely.
Somebody... So if I had a bunch of plants I wanted to maybe trade for some fruit, just show up on Thursday?
Yes, absolutely
and
do that.
And how does it work?
They're out there. They have it on a display. You take what you want. If you don't have anything to give, that's fine too. If you need fruit, you know, to eat or whatever, that's fine. And but if you can donate what you can, you know, it's a nice community event. They and this is, you know, we're trying not to take it from people who, you know, who do it for a living. Because that's not, you know, we want them to make their living too. But it's like fruit that would ordinarily, you know, it would just fall to the ground anyways. And it wouldn't, you know, do anybody any good. And or, you know, it's too, you know, too expensive for certain people to purchase. Coming, you know, come and take what you can and use and, you know, share. And, you know, the bounty of this island. There's no reason really that we should be shipping over quite so much fruit. But of course, you know, that's also been the way things have been done for a while. And there are lots of things, lots of processed food and other things that do need to be shipped over. But so much of what you can eat and nurture yourself on can be from the island.
Mm-hmm. Any other advice for our listeners or any other... things that you are holding out on us that
be nice to bicyclists. Mm. I hope to be and pedestrians. It is such a nice way to get around and enjoy this area, and we need to share the road. And while Pratt Road, you know, you can go through it to a certain extent, sometimes we have to be on the main highway. And it's, you know, it's a really, if you can, try to save a few trips so that you can just walk it or bike it and not take the car. And having said that, the rain did discourage me today. Mm-hmm. But
and you're saying that, I'm sure, for health reasons as well as to help not put more toxins in the air.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, reduce. It's hard, I know, because the easy thing and the thing we've been accustomed to do is to use fossil fuel, you know, gas generators, you know, gas this and that, you know. And, you know, it's a lifestyle. It's habits that, you know, are tough to break, and I understand that. But where you can make changes, you know, do it little by little. And, you know, go with, you know, solar and wind electricity where you can and where you can't. Because I do understand that at the outset, you know, electrical is pricier. But in the long run, it's the fossil fuel that's going to cost us and our generation more.
Well, and I'm seeing there's just so many things that are battery operated now. I remember when the electric screwdriver came out, everybody kind of poo-pooed it. It wasn't going to be as powerful. And now you hardly see someone use a screwdriver that's not electric or drills. Or mm-hmm. And we're starting to see it with lawn equipment, too. I know we have a electric riding lawnmower that...
Oh, you do? That's what I need, too.
Yes, and it's and surprisingly, it lasts pretty long, and it cuts the grass pretty well. And yeah, and I see... Yeah. More and more of the companies, even the companies that were very well known for being gas operated, now offer batteries for weed whackers. And
yes.
So it's definitely coming along.
Yes. And we need to offer more like solar generators where, you know, the generator, you can plug it in, but you can also use the PV panels to recharge that generator. Mm-hmm. Now people will say, oh, you know, that's what an, you know, a regular stationary PV system is. Mm-hmm. Well, true that, but, you know, when that doesn't work, mm-hmm. you need a quick fix. Mm-hmm. And so you need to build in that kind of redundancy into off-grid living and solar and renewable living. And like, you know, a solar phone charger. Mm-hmm. Man, did I need that, but I didn't have it. So those are the kinds of things I advocate and would be so wonderful for our islands.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Phoenix Chung, for being here today. You've been a wonderful guest, and I look forward to chatting with you more about this off-grid living.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having this.
This is Holly Allgood. This is Two Tunes Talk Story here on KNKR LP 96.1 FM Kohala. Aloha. Ah, kou make e hana kou.